The second case on the 130 docket at this time, and that is People Against Ragusa. And as soon as you're able to set up, you may do so. And once you're comfortable, you may proceed with your argument. And if I'm mispronouncing that name, please disabuse me of that.
May it please the court. My name is Shan Jeffrey. I'm here on behalf of Patricia Ragusa. Can you hear me now? Okay. Your Honors, based on the outrage in my office about this case, there are several of my colleagues present in the room today. So for their benefit, here's a brief statement of the facts. Patricia Ragusa, a certified public accountant, paid two private defense lawyers $100,000 to zealously advocate for her at her criminal trial, at which she faced over 100 counts of theft and computer crime, a serious case. She believed she had paid for the undivided loyalties of her defense team. Instead, when her lawyers could not convince her to plead guilty, they went behind her back, and unbeknownst to her, they made records in front of the judge, the prosecutor, and the court reporter to defame her character in an attempt to discredit her because they already anticipated that she might be filing post-conviction claims against them. Two such hearings were conducted in the deliberate absence of Ms. Ragusa, one on the eve of trial and one mid-trial. When these lawyers also attempted to make a self-serving record as part of the Curtis advisement, the trial court finally cut it off, and the first time that Ms. Ragusa learned of her trial attorney's disloyalty was when she read my opening brief in prison, where she sobbed audibly as she read the arguments.
Counsel, was a motion for a new trial made by Ms. Ragusa?
No, because she still did not know about these hearings until the case was already on direct appeal.
She didn't know about it till you obtained the transcript?
Absolutely not. She did not know anything about this until it was on appeal.
Assuming the lack of ethical standards, arguendo.
Okay.
This was a jury trial.
Yes.
And these comments were not made in front of the jury.
True.
And the comments went to the core of a potential plea bargain.
Not only that, Your Honor, the comments went to the fact that they felt she was foolish for not taking it,
granted,
that she was manipulative and not to be trusted, because they were trying to cover themselves on a potential claim that they saw down the road coming back to haunt them.
That's your judgment, that they were potentially claiming?
Well, it's in the record that they said they felt they were being set up and being made a target. Okay. That is my interpretation, Your Honor, but I feel it's a completely reasonable one.
And in addition, these lawyers actually defended the case through verdict.
Yes, because she was completely unaware through the course of the trial that this had happened.
Three times now. I think I understand it.
Okay. I was just answering his question. All right. First, I would like to address the right to be present. But let me back up, because it sounds like you're putting credence on the fact that the jury did not hear these hearings, and I want to talk about that for a second.
I'm not putting credence on anything.
Okay.
I'm simply looking at the record, and it does occur to me,
yes,
that there is a distinction between a situation where there's a jury trial and a situation where the trial court is actually the finder of fact as to guilt.
There is a
I think the cases actually do recognize that distinction.
Well, there is a distinction if you're looking for harm from trial error, Your Honor. But here we have three claims that go to whether or not they have failed in their representation. The first one is conflict of interest. And if you can prove up a conflict of interest, the reason that you don't have to show prejudice is because when you have a conflicted lawyer, you don't know what the trial might have looked like with an unconflicted lawyer. You don't know what the evidence might have been with zealous advocacy and undivided loyalties. And that's why the standard of review is automatic reversal once you prove up an actual conflict and that it affected representation.
Well, so there's a difference between actual conflict and potential conflict. Is that correct?
There is, but I think when
And let me ask you, in looking at the case of People versus Hodges, decided by another division of this court in 2005, it indicates, and I give you a quick overview of it,
sure,
neither animosity between defendant and the attorneys concerning the strength of the case constitutes actual conflict of interest. And if there's no conflict of actual conflict of interest, don't we look at this in a different way than you suggested?
I don't think that's the right framework for looking at what happened here, Your Honor. We're not just talking about whether there was conflict behind the scenes between the client and the lawyer about whether this deal should be taken or whether the case should go to trial. No. What we're talking about here is the lawyers deliberately making a record to the court reporter about what they feel to be foolish decisions and manipulative behavior on the part of their own client in her absence, so that there will be a record made for them to refer to later on when she comes back and says, I want my money back, I think you were ineffective, or whatever the post-conviction litigation that they're scared of being set up on. Whatever that is, they are making a record here during her trial. They are litigating on behalf of their own legal interests the detriment of Ms. Ragusa's interests.
Phrased another way, that you're suggesting that the situation here where the attorneys reveal confidences go behind their client's back.
On the record.
On the record.
Yes.
In an effort to preserve some position to their advantage. That
legal position
as a matter of law created an actual conflict.
Yes, Your Honor, it did, because they're representing their own legal interests. In a sense, they are advocating for themselves. They are being lawyers representing their own legal interests, setting themselves up for a defense to a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel later, while they're supposed to be zealously advocating for their client at trial. During the trial, this occurred.
The situation, the question with you, if I may, the plea bargain which the prosecution offered, as I understand it, and which they recommended to their client, would have been a sentence of 5 years or something like that.
Was what? I'm sorry?
Sentence of 5 years.
No, 4 to 12, I believe, is what's stated in the record.
12.
And she got 15.
Beg pardon?
She got 15 after trial.
So she refused that.
She did.
And she got a controlling sentence of about 15 years.
Right.
Is that correct?
Through concurrent sentences.
And are you saying is it your argument that her counsel, because of these potential conflicts, was ineffective?
Your Honor,
is that part of your argument that they
were ineffective? That's part of it, because, and here's why.
Just answer my question, that they were ineffective.
Okay, I sort of got lost in your question, so let me back up just a little and tell you why I think they were ineffective. If this is what you're asking me, you can clarify.
I just ask you, is that part of your argument that they were ineffective counsel?
Okay, give the reason again and I'll answer, I'm sorry.
Is it part of your argument?
Yes.
That the counsel that she had,
yes,
whom she now terminated, fired,
yes,
that they were ineffective in her representation?
Yes, because...
Well, I'm not asking the because, I'm just asking whether they were. Now you can go on with your argument if you'd like.
Okay.
But if they were ineffective, don't we look at the Strickland test?
No,
we
don't. Not in this case, Your Honor, because of the reason that they were ineffective. And the reason...
Why were they ineffective in the record? Not what you think or how you feel.
Okay.
But why were they ineffective?
Because there is no failure of representation greater than advocating against your own client.
Well, when did they, how did they?
And that's in Ray Prescott on page 28 of my opening.
How did they advocate against her?
Because they discredited her.
How did they do it?
They made records to her detriment in front of the judge that was ruling on motions in the case and in front of the prosecutor. Your Honor, let me quote the U.S. Supreme Court here for a second, because the role of the adversary system is at play here. And when you have a lawyer who is winking at the prosecutor and the judge apologizing for bringing the case to trial because of their perception of guilt or their perception that they just shouldn't be there at all because the plea bargain was reasonable, there's no adversary system there anymore. And even when a defense lawyer may be convinced before trial that a defense is wholly frivolous, that opinion does not qualify his or her duty to the client. And any constraints based on ethical violation or ethical considerations rather do not qualify a lawyer's obligation to maintain the stigma of guilt may not attach to the client until the presumption of innocence is overcome. And that's straight from the U.S. Supreme Court in McCoy v. Court of Appeals of Wisconsin.
Ms. Adams, if you were right that this was, as a matter of law, an actual conflict, does it make any difference whether the counsel was ineffective?
No, because it's per se reversal. And the reason that we have not brought ineffectiveness under Strickland is because we can't, because there has to be an evidentiary hearing pursuant to a 35C motion. That all has to be developed in a post-conviction proceeding where they can talk about what happened behind the scenes, where they can talk about whether they brought the most vigorous defense they could have, where Ms. Ragusa claims she should have had an expert witness on her side to testify about the audits, whether that should have been done. We don't have the record for that, and that's why we cannot proceed on direct appeal. And in fact, this court and the Supreme Court have expressed a preference for those claims to be litigated in 35C motions because they need a new evidentiary record for those claims most of the time. I would also like to address my other two arguments on appeal, but I'll save that for rebuttal. Thank
counsel,
you.
Let me just ask you a question. The
okay.
One situation that might justify counsel making disclosure of privileged communication would be the Schultheis situation. Was this a Schultheis hearing that happened on November 7th? I can't figure out from the record what caused this hearing to
It's hard to answer that because the strict interpretation of Schultheis has now sort of been made more vague in subsequent case law. So if you're talking about the actual kind of hearing that happened in the Schultheis case, where lawyers are afraid that they're going to put on perjured testimony. No, that's not the case here, because obviously they put on Ms. Ragusa and she testified in her own defense, and there was no such hearing like that.
So what precipitated that first hearing? Why did they go in there and make these statements about the client not accepting the plea bargain? What caused that in-camera proceeding?
Because they were angry with her for not taking the plea bargain. They wanted to keep the $100,000 and not take the case to trial. And now they were caught off guard and they needed to start making a record about how unreasonable it was to have to take the case.
What did they actually say? How did they get the?
They said they needed to be officers of the court and make this important record because they felt they were being set up by their client.
And that's in the transcript.
It is.
The transcript you gave us is in the transcript elsewhere.
No, that language is in the transcript. Actually, I can't remember if it's the first hearing or the second one, Your Honor. But here's a quote right out of the transcript, and this is from Volume 8, page 213 and 14. And this also highlights
Where is that?
Volume 8, page 213 and 14. It's either Appendix A or B of my opening brief. Mm-hmm. And this also highlights an important point, which is these defense lawyers were making these records behind the back of their client. They were giving her pretextual reasons for going back here and making these records, and they were not about to let her fire them. They knew that if she were there listening to what they had to say, she would have fired them. So here's right out of the lips of the defense lawyers.
Speculation.
Rob and I are certainly not going to quit. We're not going to let her fire us if that ever were to come. But we just feel, as officers of the court, we're very concerned that we're being set up. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Adams.
Good Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Adams. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to pick up where defense counsel left off and talk a bit about the reference to Schultheis in the hearings. The defense attorneys referenced that case in both of the hearings. In the initial hearing, talking about the guilty plea, they said, we believe it's appropriate to make a brief Schultheis record.
Did they make a Schultheis record, in your opinion?
Well,
a Schultheis issue here? That's what I'm trying to understand.
There was no allegations that the defendant was going to present perjured testimony, which are the specific facts of that case.
So Schultheis was just the password they used to get in to see the judge in camera?
Well, I'm not sure what went on to precipitate the hearing in camera. I'm not sure what went on to get them back into chambers. But I believe when they referenced that case, they were merely talking about the broader holding of that case, not the narrow facts of that case. I don't think that there was ever any allegation that they believed that the defendant was going to present perjured testimony. And again, when the court referenced that case again in the second hearing on the third day of trial, I believe he was again referring to whether or not we had a situation where the defendant wanted to have counsel removed from the case. But again, it was not about presenting perjured testimony, and
isn't the Schultheis case really the broad scope of the Schultheis case? The facts were a perjured witness, potential perjured witness. But the Schultheis case statement was that when there's a need for the attorney to make a record regarding a matter of sensitivity between the attorney and his client, that there's a method by which you do it, and which is to ask the trial judge to allow them to make a record before the reporter without the counsel for the prosecution or the judge being present. Isn't that the Schultheis case?
Yes, I think taken beyond its facts, yes, Your Honor.
But of course here the record was not made without the trial judge present. It was made with the trial judge present and with the prosecutor present.
Well, I'm not sure that record was ever made. On the third day of trial, the court said if this becomes an issue and we need to make a hearing on a Schultheis, have a Schultheis hearing, let me know.
But the representations that were made by counsel were made outside the presence of the defendant, but in the presence of the trial court and in the presence of the prosecutor here.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it wasn't the structure that Schultheis envisioned at all.
Right, and I don't think that anyone's saying that that's what we had here. They referenced that case a couple of times during the course of these hearings, but that's not actually what was done in this case. Now, whether or not there was an ethical violation here, whether or not defense counsel disclosed confidential communications, is a separate issue from whether or not we have an actual conflict of interest.
Why?
Well, presumably you could have an ethical violation that rises to the level of an actual conflict of interest.
Does it rise to a level of actual conflict when you're taking a position adverse to your client?
I don't believe that they were taking a position adverse to their client.
Well, don't they admit as much on the record?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, no. I think that initially they stated that they believed that the defendant should have taken the plea agreement.
Well, I don't see that as being adverse. I do see it as being adverse when the lawyers tell the judge, we're not going to let this lady fire us. Don't you worry, Judge, we're not going to mess your trial up. We're not going to let this happen. Is that that does at a very minimum suggest that they had a concern about it, doesn't it?
Well, I believe that the defendant had expressed some dissatisfaction with her attorneys, and this is what they were relaying to the trial court. This is not a situation where the defendant was completely in the dark about any conflicts with her attorney. According to the defense counsel in the record, she had viciously attacked them for not caring about her case, presenting a patsy defense, and she had numerous other choice words for her defense attorneys as well. So she already had adverse feelings towards her counsel, according to the record that we have. To her, that did not rise to the level that she wanted to have them removed from the case. She did not say anything to the trial court that she didn't want these attorneys representing her.
Well, she couldn't have, could she? That's a straw man argument.
I'm not suggesting at all that because of what was done in chambers, but what was done in her presence, they were clearly having a great deal of animosity and a great deal of discussion about what the proper defense should be, about the way in which her attorneys were cross-examining witnesses, about her feelings on the way in which they were doing their job. She was not happy, according to them, with the way that they were presenting her defense, and she had made a statement to them that if this continues, I may want to rethink this. I mean, she was paying for these attorneys. She could fire them at any point, and she never did that.
Counsel, what do you make of the statement at the end of that hearing then? We will not advise her of this hearing.
No, that wasn't the first hearing.
That's what this was about. Yes, yeah, so the first hearing. We're not gonna, not only are we telling you this, Judge, but we're going to keep her in the dark about what we told you. And if she asks us about it, we're not going to tell her what this was about. Does that present an actual conflict with your client?
No, again, what they had told the judge in that particular instance was that they thought she should take this plea. The reasons why they felt that way could run the gamut. But these were the same things that they had already told the defendant. They had told her numerous times that they thought that she should take this plea, that this was in her best interest, that she should not go to trial.
But they hadn't told her that we're going to tell the prosecutor we feel this way. They hadn't told her that we're going to tell the judge we feel this way. They hadn't told her that we're going to make a record that we feel this way. And they certainly didn't tell her after they did it that they made such a record.
But again,
doesn't that present a conflict of interest?
But a conflict of interest, an actual conflict, the defendant has to show that there was some adverse effect on their representation of her at trial.
How is she supposed to show that here? If I had fired these guys and hired a new lawyer, I would have had a different result. How is she?
No, she does not have to go that far. We don't require prejudice here. So she does not have to show that if she had had different counsel, the result of the trial would have been different. That's not what's required. But she does have to show that there was something that counsel did or did not do to which he had conflicting duties, and she has to be able to show that the course taken was influenced by these conflicting loyalties that defense counsel was under. I've yet to understand what those conflicting loyalties are and what adverse effect they may have had on this trial. There's nothing in the record that shows that these defense attorneys did not zealously advocate for their client. The fact that they believe she should have taken a plea bargain doesn't mean that they're not going to zealously advocate for her.
Does that make any difference?
The fact that they wanted her to take a plea bargain?
No, that they zealously advocated on behalf of their clients at the merits. Does that make any difference here?
Well, of course, Your Honor.
And how?
Because
if there's an actual conflict.
But there's only an actual conflict if there's an adverse effect. And if there's no adverse effect, there's not an actual conflict requiring reversal. She has to be able to point to something in the record and say, this was done, this was not done, and the reason it was done or not done is because of these conflicting loyalties.
It seems what wasn't done here is that she didn't get a chance to fire her counsel because she didn't know the full story.
Well, and that's speculative to say that she even would have fired her counsel had she been advised of this. She had already been heard screaming at her counsel that she didn't like the defense they were putting on, that she didn't like the way they were cross-examining her witnesses, that she didn't think that they cared about her case. If all of those things were not enough for her to fire her lawyer, the fact that, as she puts it, they were tattling on her, I'm not sure is going to push her over the edge that she would have fired her attorney had she been made aware of the conversation. That's completely speculative.
Well, there are two thoughts that crossed my mind in this discussion. First, as I mentioned to counsel for the appellant, that People versus Hodges, it's in the case of another division of this court in 2005, the long and short of that case is the animosity between the defendant and the attorneys concerning the strength of the case does not constitute actual conflict of interest. And the second has to do with that Curtis advisement. Now, admittedly, she didn't know what was happening in these in-camera proceedings at the time during the course of the trial, when the trial judge gave her the Curtis advisement, which was telling her that she has the right to testify and that's her decision, et cetera, et cetera. What is the value of that, if any, in your perspective?
Well, as to your first question, if the defendant had argued that there was a conflict in the trial court, simply saying that she had animosity toward her counsel or did not agree with their defense strategy would not have been enough for the court to find an actual conflict of interest. So the fact that there was animosity between the two of them or that she disagreed with their trial strategy, that's not enough to rise to the level of an actual conflict.
Well, those cases are about appointed counsel, though. Those cases are about whether...
But the right to conflict-free counsel is the same. Now, certainly she had the right to fire her attorney at any time because she was paying for that attorney. But if this came up mid-trial, she's still going to have to show that there was an actual conflict in order to entitle her to a continuance in order to retain new counsel. If she were to make this motion and the court found that there was, in fact, no conflict while in the midst of trial, the court was entitled to balance her interest in finding new title against the efficient administration of justice and could, in fact, require her to either go forward with the counsel she currently has or represent herself at trial. And there's been no argument made that had she been given that option, she would have proceeded pro se rather than going forward with the counsel that she had. So while it certainly is different whether or not you have appointed counsel or not, you still have the same rights with regard to conflict-free counsel. And as to the Curtis advisement, I'm not sure that the conversation didn't go very far. Defense counsel had advised the defendant that there were two very competent and very versed prosecutors. The defendant said yes. And then he went on to say, we've advised you that those are from our experience, and this is our first trial or our fourth trial. The court said stop. And that was the end of that. So there wasn't really anything said there that, first of all, it was all in the defendant's presence. And second of all, there wasn't anything said that indicated any sort of bias or animosity toward the defendant. If she's going to make a choice as to whether or not she should testify, she needs to know that she's facing two very versed prosecutors who are going to harshly cross-examine her, and she needs to weigh that in making her decision.
Ms. Adams, forgive me for going back and plowing old ground again, but there's an issue that I'm wrestling with. Is it enough, assuming, one, there's an actual conflict, is it enough to constitute harm that what has effectively happened here is the client has lost their choice? And what I mean by that is we can't speculate. It's quite possible, I suppose, both results. She could have kept her counsel, she could have fired her counsel, but that's not the issue. The issue is it enough that she doesn't, the choice has been taken out of her hands?
Well, I think, again, those are two separate issues. Whether she was deprived of her right to choice of counsel is one issue, and whether or not there was a conflict with the counsel that she had is another issue. And I think that with the counsel that she had, again, we keep coming back to this, but whether or not there's an actual conflict, there has to be an adverse effect. So there have to be competing loyalties, and there have to be decisions that counsel made or didn't make as a result of these competing loyalties.
Yeah, that's, and I'm on board. My point is that the adverse effect is arguably the client has all of a sudden lost her choice to counsel.
Well, and again, I think it's hard to answer that because we just don't know if she would have made a different decision had she been given the option.
And I'm suggesting to you that it doesn't make any difference. I guess I'm not suggesting, I'm asking. does it make any difference?
Does it make any difference?
Yes, does it make any difference whether she would have kept him or fired him?
Not for the point of determining whether or not there was a conflict of interest.
And my question goes beyond that and says, and also for the point of determining, hasn't the choice, the right to make the choice, been removed from her hands?
She always had the right to choose.
Once they made the decision to keep that colloquy secret, she lost her choice.
Well, she lost knowledge of one factor in making her choice, but she had all of the time that she had spent with counsel, she had all of the things that she'd been discussing with them over the course of these proceedings to make that choice. And despite indicating some dissatisfaction with counsel and, you know, with the defense of the case and the cross-examination of witnesses, she never once indicated that she wanted new counsel.
Under the Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case, Gonzales-Lopez, on which she relies quite a bit, the Supreme Court said when you're denied your choice of counsel, you don't have to make any, there has to be no showing of prejudice or harm. Does that apply here?
Well, and again, I think it's difficult to analyze a choice of counsel claim when she never actually made a choice.
Are you finished with the answer to Judge Richmond's question?
Well, I'm not sure I answered your question, Judge, but...
Well, I want you to... Have you read and considered People versus Harlan? That was the case 54 Pacific 3rd, 871.
I'm not recalling that case, Judge.
And prior to that, the Rodriguez case, which was a capital case, and Mr. Rodriguez was found guilty and was sentenced to death and lived for 20 years in the penitentiary before he died of natural causes. There we got into a conflict of interest. There's something that sticks in my mind on ineffective assistance and how it was right at that essentially every many, many times the ineffective assistance of counsel arises out of the facts that the third person is found guilty. Do you have any comment on Harlan or Rodriguez?
I'm not familiar enough with those cases, Judge, to comment on those. I apologize.
Thank
if
you,
the court
Ms.
has no further questions, I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Ask that this court affirm. Thank you.
Are you familiar with either Harlan or Rodriguez?
I am, but not really in the context that you're asking about.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Once Ms. Raguso was excluded from these secret hearings, she was denied any meaningful exercise of choice of counsel. It doesn't matter that she didn't say on the record here, Judge, I want to fire my lawyers, because she would have said that, or at least it's fair inference that she would have said that, had she been present at these hearings that were held in camera. And that's why she was excluded from them in the first place.
Who excluded her?
Her lawyers did when they asked for hearings.
Who called the in-camera hearing?
Her lawyers did.
Did they?
The first time they absolutely did. The second time they used an opportunity where they were already back in camera to go beyond what the original purpose of the hearing was supposed to be about to make another record against Ms. Raguso. So that was opportunistic, but they did that as well.
The second time was a sequestration problem.
Yes, opportunistic on their part. Yes. Opposing counsel concedes that Ms. Raguso was already dissatisfied with the services of her defense lawyers. She had a constitutional right to choice of counsel. So how is it possible that this was not a critical stage of trial at which she had a constitutional right to be present so that she could meaningfully exercise her right to choice of counsel? That's issue two.
You said that in every case in the Colorado Supreme Court and divisions of this court, have we said that the absence of the defendant in any type of proceeding in any court is tantamount to a reversal?
Have you said that?
Yes. Has any court said that?
No, but that's not my argument either, Your Honor.
She missed this one. She wasn't at this one, and that's why she's...
Well, she wasn't at this critical stage of trial where she could have meaningfully exercised her constitutional right to choice of counsel.
Ms. Adams, thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adams. There's not an echo in here. Excuse me, Ms. Jeffries. I apologize. I'll remember that. Yeah. That concludes our 1:30 docket. The matter is